The new book, Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson by best-selling author Mark Kriegel, is a story about fame, race, greed, criminality, trauma, and the creation of the most feared and mesmerizing fighter in the history of boxing. In a life that included incarceration and molestation, booze, coke, the death of a child, and perhaps most treacherous of all, fame, Mike Tyson has nevertheless survived. What's more, decades removed from his short-lived prime, we are still very interested in Mike Tyson. The new book, Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Kriegel to the roundtable this morning. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Former sports columnist for the New York Post and the New York Daily News and a boxing analyst and essayist for ESPN. So obviously, Mike Tyson has been on your radar for a long time.
I was covering cops as a general assignment reporter, basically, at the Daily News in 88. And I get a call. I've been there a couple weeks, basically, and I get a call. Run off to Harlem right now. Go to Dapper Dan's. What's Dapper Dan's? Is it like a club? No, it's an all-night clothing store. Go. He just got into a street fight with a guy by the name of Mitch Blood Green. And, you know, the assignment at the time was, like, it was kind of a goof running around the city. It generated a lot of adrenaline. And the story generated a lot of heat. When I look back on it, it was the beginning of a kid. And that's really all he was then. Imploding or exploding. I'm not sure. He might have done a bit of both. But when I look back on those years, the Barbara Walters interview, getting a tip that he had like just torn up his mansion in Bernardsville. I mean, he's still like 21 years old. It's a kid coming apart. And to me, when I look back on it, I remember that Barbara Walters interview playing almost on a loop in the newsroom.
Right.
And it's like the genesis of tabloid culture, what we now call tabloid culture. Maybe at this point, maybe it's long since gone mainstream. But to me, that's where it begins.
And that's the one where his wife is in the room and pointing fingers that she has been physically abused by this man.
Physically, mentally, and he's sort of just hanging out in the, what's the word I want? He's not offering much resistance.
Right. And seems almost dazed.
As scary as he was, apparently he was pacified when around her.
Of course, for those of us who live in the in northeastern New York, know a lot about the Mike Tyson story because we were a part of it in the sense of his trainer, Customato. You write a lot about this legendary trainer and what was so often referred to as Mike Tyson's father figure. I'm hoping you can put into some context for us his real background, his real relationship with his parents, and then where D'Amato comes in.
He had very little in the way of a relationship with his real parents. I mean, his dad split very early. And his mother was broken by it, and she descends into alcoholism and street life. So to me, that's the biggest hole in Tyson's life. And I don't mean to sound like Freud here, but it's also the hole he can never quite fill or hasn't quite filled it until really his most recent marriage and this kind of unlikely comeback. But even when he's a kid, after he meets D'Amato and starts getting some acclaim as a fighter, he still doesn't win her approval, her respect, her approbation. She's basically checked out. And then she passes away in 1982. It's a hole he can never fix. As a matter of fact, I came across a psychologist he was seeing in the late 90s, early 2000s, and she has to move. And they've gotten very, very close. She was an older woman from Scottsdale, Arizona, but she too had been, you know, assaulted as a kid. And they've become very close. And she explains to Mike that she won't be able to be treating him anymore. And he goes, you know, that's okay. I'm realizing more and more. I don't think I necessarily need a shrink, but I need a mother. would you be my mother? I think that's a through line that runs through, that certainly runs through this story. And by the way, I mean, I spent most of the 90s in my column just beating the hell out of him. He was, and you know, some of it was overboard, some of it was full on right, but this is not a guy I came to de-villainize easily. But again, that runs through this whole first volume, which ends, my book ends in 1988.
So when it comes to Castamato, Tyson tells you, quote, as long as people know my name, they're going to know his. My existence is his glory. How true is that?
It's incontrovertible. However, he was pushing back on something. We had just a couple of conversations basically to establish ground rules, because I had no expectation he's going to go through his whole life story for Mark Kriegel, you know, for free. And I don't do as told to. I try not to do as told to books. So we were talking, and I know some of the people in his inner circle, and I'm certainly familiar with the fable of Castamato and the kid. You know, he rescues Tyson from Tryon, where he'd been incarcerated. He makes him a champion and all the rest of it. And Cuss, very unusual figure. He was eccentric. He was brilliant. He was paranoid. But when he brings Tyson out of Tryon, when he, you know, gives him a home for basically for the first time, it's not a simple mission of like rehabilitating the kid. It's not a simple mission of maybe we'll find out what he has as a fighter. He doesn't say, hey, we'll put you in the Golden Glove, see how you do. Maybe we'll turn you pro one day, or you'll go to school, you'll get a GED, whatever the case may be. But from the beginning, it's about you're going to be the greatest, the baddest, the youngest. You're going to go down in history. And what I suggested to Tyson was, you know, I'm not necessarily sure he did you nothing but favors, and that what essentially he's asking you to do for him is make me Castamato immortal. And that's the question I pose: make me live forever. And that's not an inconsiderable burden for a 13-year-old kid who's been on the street and been locked up. And when I posed this to Tyson, that's when he said what he said, the quote, which I think is central to the book. You know, what he doesn't ask after that is, yes, I made him immortal, but what was the price? And I think that that's a fair question to ask. And I think that the fable of Cuss and the Kid, much of which was written by sports writers and columnists who were incredibly precious and important to me in the business and me growing up as a writer, it was a wonderful story. But it lacked nuance, and it wasn't in full. And it was incumbent on me to examine that. One of the peculiarities of that fable is so powerful that Tyson, he's singular in a lot of aspects, but especially this, he had literary pedigree before he had street cred, which, if you think about it, should blow you away.
Right.
You know?
Right. So, I mean, some of the quotes in the book are really incredible when it comes to what Castamato is telling Tyson. Your objective is to push his nose into the back of his head. You throw punches with bad intentions. You are a scourge from God. The world will know your name from now until the eons of oblivion. That's something to tell a teenager.
Right. By the way, that's something to tell a teenager under hypnosis.
Correct.
It's too simple to just write off Cuss as a crazy old man. He wasn't. And there were reasons that some of America's best or most interesting writers kept coming back, because he was giving them great material. And boxing itself is great material. But, I mean, again, I asked that question. Do you take this kid who's been locked up and on the street and then tell him, you know, you're Alexander the Great? And if you do, what's going to happen? To me, there's a Faustian bargain here, which is that D'Amato, who had been a great trainer, who famously made Floyd Patterson the youngest heavyweight champion, had been in exile and sort of written off as a as a crazy old crank. So he needed Tyson to make him matter, and again, make him matter forever. But I think that it's not a surprise then that there would be some crack up in Mike's future.
The name of the book is Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson. And Mark Kriegel is our guest on the roundtable this morning. When it comes to the end of that and the breakup, if you will, none of that really is pretty. But talk a little bit about the people who were in his circle besides D'Amato, and how that transformation began of how he was taken under the wing of some other very powerful people.
I think you're talking about Don King.
Yes.
About the great promoter, the industrious promoter, the hardest working promoter, and without question, the smartest and most resourceful. Tyson had been warned about King and other promoters from the time he met Cus, and the plan was to keep him independent and under the control of D'Amato, and after D'Amato passed away, which he did in November of 85, the first guy in charge is supposed to be a D'Amato protege named Jimmy Jacobs,
right,
who was the world's greatest handball player and a relentless, functioned as a kind of relentless PR guy, deal maker. The problem with Jimmy, or one of the problems with Jimmy, is that he was dying. So he passes away in early 1988, and that leaves that's the last real connection to D'Amato. Again, what I find objectionable about this is that Jimmy Jacobs had a form of cancer, was diagnosed in 1980, before, perhaps as early as 79, before he even met Mike Tyson. And it's obvious that D'Amato is getting on in years, and that there's this rush to make Tyson Tyson before D'Amato dies. But what they never told the kid is that Jimmy's dying. So if Cus is going to leave Tyson in D'Amato's care, then the least Jimmy could do is make plans for the day when he's no longer around. In fact, they did, but when Jimmy Jacobs is very close to his deathbed, they bring Tyson into the New York State Athletic Commission, and he signs a series of deals which are, you don't have to be a fan of Don King, which I'm most certainly not, which just aren't kosher. You know, they brought him in. They signed a whole series of documents that entitled Jacobs' widow to his share of the purse, and another guy, Bill Caton's widow, to his end of the purse if anything should happen to them. But by any measure, this is not the way you handle a prospect. This is not the way you handle anyone, much less under the auspices of the New York State Athletic Commission. One of the consequences of how well Jimmy and Cus built Tyson is that they created or helped to create a prize that was so incredibly lucrative, it wound up corrupting everything and everyone who touched it. The guy who realized this, who realized where there were political openings and where there was a place for him, despite whatever Tyson had been warned, was Don King. And, Don King was, Tyson being controlled by all these older white guys. And Don King figured it out, like, hey, this is a kid from Brownsville, Brooklyn. And maybe he's not entirely comfortable with this. And he was, in fact, not. And he also represented the streets, Don King. And Tyson found that attractive as well. So there's a passage early in the book and from Mike's own autobiography where there's a question, who's my father? Is it like the livery cab driver? Or was it this guy who was sort of half a pimp? And Tyson finds himself hoping like hell that his dad is the pimp, because he wants a guy who has some standing on the street, who's a gangster, the tough guy. And in King, who had already done time and been a wunderkind numbers boss in Cleveland, King provided all of that. King was the street writ large. He was also absolutely brilliant and fearless and without a sense of limitation. So despite whatever warning Tyson has been given about Don King. It's almost like in some larger metaphorical sense, King is telling Tyson, you know, Luke, I am your father. Come with me. And I think at some level, especially in the maelstrom that was his life at that time, Tyson finds that attractive and comforting. I mean, remember, he's a 20, 21-year-old kid.
One of the things I wanted to mention, simply because this is a local story for the Capital Region as well. I mean, you say in here that Tyson loved cruising Albany, say, compared to Catskill, which is like one red light in the whole town. Albany was the closest thing to Brooklyn. And that's fascinating. I mean, I think people who obviously remember his career, I remember going up and seeing the fight that was on ABC at the Glens Falls Civic Center, which was a huge deal. And I also remember the problems he had at Crossgates Mall in that story, which came out. There was a lot there, and sort of really an idea of what was to come, right?
The Crossgates Mall anticipates a lot of sort of is a template for what was to come, and how he was, again, I don't think it was in his best interest, sort of enabled. He never heard the word no, so he throws a tantrum in a clothing store. Maybe he makes a pass at a woman, or it was a sales girl or not. I'm not sure, but he gets tossed out of the mall. And, you know, later on, his handlers brag about, you know, paying off the Albany cops or using, you know, higher ups in the Albany Police Department to put a kibosh on certain things. I think that Tyson was actually happiest, certainly in his young life. He had a friend by the name of Rory Holloway, who later became his manager and a figure of some controversy. But as kids, I think he was happiest cruising around, you know, Albany with Rory and, you know, going to Sal DiCarlo strip joint, because he had just become famous, and he was certainly locally famous, and he, you know, energized certain venues like the Egg, the convention center. I mean, he made that a destination,
right,
for a time, the Latham Coliseum. And those, the early chapters, the way that he connects with the fans in the Capital Region is really extraordinary, because he wasn't built like any other fighter. But I think those were really the happiest years, because he was famous, but not famous in the way, in this grand American way that could be lethal, like, you know, the type of he had fame in a dose that could kill you, like Elvis or Marilyn Monroe or whoever. And it's a damn wonder that it didn't. But in those early years in the Capital Region, yeah, he was happy. And, you know, his handlers were also really suspicious of Albany and Rory, because they didn't want him going back to anything that could approximate Brooklyn. They didn't want to have anything that was not under their control. And Tyson, it was inevitable, from my perspective, that Tyson would rebel against that.
When it comes to, as you say, the story goes to what, 88, what was the natural break for you that was the place for this part of the story to end?
Joe, I was not crazy about the prospect of writing this book, because I had to confront, you know, who I was when I wrote all this stuff about him, and I wasn't particularly keen on revisiting the 90s. And I made this sort of phony bargain with myself that maybe I could write a slim volume, a kind of essay about fighting and writing, with Tyson as the through line. And I don't think I'm smart enough or good enough to write that kind of book. Also, Tyson generates so much story. And as I sat down to research and write and report, it kept getting fuller and fuller and fuller. So a couple years into this, I'm having lunch with my editor, and he seems to be very happy with the pages, which that's great. And I said, you know, I'm glad you like it, but we have about 80,000 words here, and he's still, I don't know, 16, 17 years old. This is not the book we discussed. And if this keeps going, you know, if this keeps going, it's going to, you know, we're going to approach like Robert Caro proportions, which we did not. But he says, can you break it anywhere? Is there a natural break? And I said, of course, absolutely not, which is the first thing I said when he broached the subject of writing about Tyson. But in fact, there is. It's the Sphinx fight in Atlantic City with Trump ascendant, and really the high point of his professional career was billed as a fight of the century, which is a term of art in boxing. It was a huge deal, to use a Trumpian phrase. But that's where we ended it. I didn't think that was the way to go at the time, because there were certain thematic points and plot points that there to pay off later. But looking back, I definitely think it was the right place to end the first volume.
The one thing I would like to talk about and end here, which is that we haven't talked about, but in the story, because there's so much about outside the ring, and obviously that's the story, but you write so beautifully about what made him great. And I think maybe that sometimes gets lost. And I'm curious as far as a fighter goes, of why he was so good, of why people would flock to places around the country, around the world, to see this guy fight.
There are a few elements of him. I don't want to minimize how good he was and how well he was trained. And the second half of his career, meaning after he gets out of jail, and I think it even begins before. I know that the decline begins after the Sphinx fight, which is the last scene you see in this book. It is a long decline, and it's a multifaceted decline. I think it's a fascinating story, mostly about fame. But what he did on the front end of his career is absolutely without precedent. He fought 15 times in the year leading up to his first title. And you're never going to see that again, certainly not from the heavyweight. American heavyweights themselves have become a rare breed. But the way he did it was one of the things that made D'Amato such an attractive figure is that he had an almost theological concept or construct about fear and standing up to the bully. The irony is that Tyson, especially in those years, was the most feared attraction in the sport, arguably the history of the sport. I've spoken to matchmakers who literally had to push guys out of the dressing room before they would, you know, make their entrance into the ring. And the irony is that Cus, who had this beautiful theory about standing up to the bully, fashioned his own signature creation as the bully writ large. And what Tyson did was take the fear, his own and yours, and redirect it onto you, the opponent, so he was scared, you know what. And that's part of the element. The other elements were the beauty of this Cus and the Kid fable, however unnuanced it was. The quality of the knockouts. In other words, when he wins the title, the way that Trevor Burbick goes down, he falls in all four corners. And there's something visually arresting, maybe even grotesque, but you can't get it out of your head. So the quality of the knockouts, the fearsomeness of the knockouts, that all went on videotape, the first generation of videotape, and was sent on VCR to sports editors and news directors around the country. And the last element was when you put the microphone in front of his face and you heard, like, yeah, I was trying to drive the bone into his nose, and you heard the quality of his voice. They seemed, it's not the easiest thing in the world reconciling the destruction you've just seen with that lilting, lisping quality in his voice and what he's actually saying. So that the combination taken together is holy, you know what. I've got to tune in. I'm going to remember who this kid is.
Mark Kriegel is a former sports columnist for the New York Post and the New York Daily News. The new book, Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson, it is published by Penguin Press. Mark Kriegel, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. The pleasure was mine.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.